Welcome to the latest edition of After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. This entire first hour is devoted to a friend of mine, but also a noted author with his first book. You wrote another book, Bill, but this one is the story of you. It's titled Riots and Rockets, A Dash of the Army, A Dose of Politics, and A Life in the Law. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Rick. I appreciate it. Good.
No. There's so many things. We went to the same high school. You went to the University of Chicago. My father went to the University of Chicago. You were married to my great friend, your first wife, Judy Royko. You spent a lot of time working politically in the 43rd Ward. That's where I was born and raised. You went to Encyclopedia Britannica, about which my father wrote the history. We're kind of like brothers somehow, Bill. Kind of
yes.
Like brothers. After you, like many people, you had retired and all of a sudden the pandemic came and you had some time on your hands. This book is one of the manifestations of that time, is it not?
It is. And of course, it begins, as not all stories do, with a terrible self-realization. I was becoming crabby early on in the lockdown. And I thought...
Who wasn't? Yeah.
So early on in the lockdown, that March of 2020, yeah. I thought this is just plain unfair to the dogs. And if it's unfair to the dogs, it's for sure unfair to my wife, Kathy. So at first, I thought the solution was to build a website. And I had fooled around trying to learn how to build a website maybe 20 years before, early on. And it didn't get very far, but I did register a simple name for the site back then that I kept. And so I got back at that, and what I found was that
What did you want to do that for? What did you want a website for?
Mostly photographs. I've taken photographs all my life, and I had thought for many decades that eventually – at the way in which databases and computing was developing, that the images would someday be able to be stored and accessed.
Of course, you were in not so roundabout way when you worked for, and we'll get to all of this, when you worked for Encyclopedia Britannica, you were really on the early pioneering levels of what eventually became this vast world known as the Internet.
Absolutely. My time there really... overlapped the era of what they call big iron, the big IBM and mainframes that dominated in the 50s and 60s and 70s, both in the university communities and in businesses. And, of course, there were no personal computers until the early 80s.
So how was it trying to start your website all by yourself?
Well, I was delighted because the tools, as I looked around, important tools were free, like WordPress, the underlying structure, is a complicated piece of software that is fairly easy to begin to get to know. So the tools to actually do something are better. And so once I discovered that, I was able to get all these family trees that my mother had done that I had along the way digitized. She'd been a great genealogist. So I got it all up on the website when a cousin said, you know, this is terrific for the family, but there's so much stuff here. You ought to talk to somebody that can help you build a better website. So
you had done in your legal career, you'd done some, and most lawyers do a lot of writing, but you'd done some writing that was not legally based. You had done some writing during your life.
Yes, and I remember getting one of the best periods of learning how to be a better writer. I remember when I took a leave of absence from the law firm to work on Bill Singer's campaign against Richard J. Daley back in the day in the 70s. The fellow running the PR at the time was a Channel 2 for the campaign, was a Channel 2 news reporter.
What's his name?
Don Randall, I think.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I remember.
He'd been a street reporter for the television channel, and then he was editing. Well, what I was doing, you know, position papers and speeches, and he was the only person around to edit this stuff and make sure it was going out properly. And the grand lesson that he taught me was with his red pencil, He attacked and murdered most of my adjectives.
Really?
And,
interesting.
And he found adjectives that would, where one adjective would replace, you know, three other words.
Sure,
so the
sure,
whole
sure.
ability to compress the writing and not be wordy. I got a great postgraduate, post-school education from that television editor because he was writing for the TV news. So,
And it certainly paid off. When you decided, building this website and gathering all these pictures, that, wait a minute, I may want to tell my own life story.
When I ran out of family trees, and I had, thanks to my mother's work back in the 50s and 60s, I had 47 families that I pretty well
good Lord
did
wow
did
wow
and but when I ran out of the family trees, then I was kind of stuck, and the lockdown was still going on.
Sure.
And I thought, well, I've got a lot of pictures from my strange period in the Army, 68 to 71.
Yeah.
So I'll write just a short history framework for that.
Mm-hmm.
And once I just started that, it just kept going and going. And when I said, well, that does it, I had about 12,000 words.
Wow.
Yeah.
The book covers that period intensely, and it gets into all the other periods in Bilbo's fascinating life. The website he is talking about is WBOWE.com. The book is titled Riots and Rockets. You can get it on Amazon. We will continue on. We barely touched on what you did. I mean, the Army stuff is fascinating. Working for the MacArthurs is fascinating. Working for United Press is fascinating. Working in politics, you were in politics in one of the most vibrant, riotous periods in this city's history. And we'll carry on after a short break. Welcome back. Don Evans, who is not here, is the creator of the Chicago Literary Hall of Fame. He has reviewed my guest, Bilbo. It's William Bo on the cover of the jacket, but Bill to me. Don has written an intriguing tour of 20th century American history from a lawyer who by happenstance sat in the first row of our most harrowing dramas. Bo seems to have been the Forrest Gump of the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and even on. He was a young intelligence officer during Vietnam. He was not spying on Viet Cong, but homegrown radicals like law school classmate Bernadine Dorn. He then got into politics and his attempts to reform the machine. Then he was on the demise of United Press International's wire service, the super rich MacArthur family, and the invention of the internet. That's a nice review that Don gave you. I know Don knows you, but he's right about all this. What you went to Latin school for high school? Where did you grow up, Bill?
I grew up on Elm Street on the near north side.
Okay.
And both my parents lived there, but also my father's brother and his family lived in the same building. So,
wow, a little compound. It's a good street. Good street. And you went to Latin, which was nearby at the time.
Yeah, I've always been indebted to the school because I had a scholarship as I went through. And
that's great.
Yeah.
And it was a block or so away.
Yeah, and it was close by. Yeah.
Block and a half away. Then you went to the University of Chicago.
For law school.
Yeah. For law school. I'm trying to look. You should see this book. It's got like a million notes here. When you decide, the time you decided to join the Army, if that's the right word, it was at the height of the Vietnam War. Were you scared about getting drafted? Were you? I find that very interesting. Very few people I know. You're a little older than I, but very few people I know said, hey, it's 1968, so I think I'll join the Army.
You're right. It was the height of the war, and you're right.
And the protests against the war, too.
Yes, although they were really not picking up the steam that they did shortly after I entered the Army and after enlisting. But one of the things that was uppermost, just not just on my mind, but of course women weren't being drafted then, and this was pre-lottery, so you were at risk. But the problem was not just for me, but for everybody. This pool of draft age men was 22 million.
Wow.
over the Vietnam years. That was the pool of males of the age that could be called. But the requirement to call wasn't that close, remotely close. There were only about 2 million. So only 2 million, about 10% of the 22 million were actually drafted. So how did it happen that they were the lucky ones, right, that had a chance to lose their life or whatever? And the answer was, as you may remember, there was a whole series of complicated draft deferment issues.
Sure.
So I found myself protected as a graduate student because the war really started when I was in the middle of law school. So they weren't yanking you out. But I could have been drafted right
after
I was. And so I grew up in a family where...
You grew up in a family where soldiering was...
Yes, indeed. So,
a bunch of soldiers.
A bunch of soldiers, the grandfathers, great-grandfather. And my father was... I was an old child, so he was young enough to go in the National Guard. He was in the National Guard. He'd enlisted when World War One came along, and he went over with the Doughboys to France.
And what happened to him over there?
He lost part of his foot, so that was an amputation. It got him home after the war was over. He was in a hospital in France. It wasn't enemy fire that did him in. He was trying to get on a troop train. And he slipped. And ouch.
But also, one of the fascinating things is later in his life, his nurse from the war came to visit your family.
So here's his nurse in Orléans, France, who'd cared for him for about a year. The healing was a terrible problem, lengthy in those days.
Yeah.
And she turned up as an old woman, and I met her. And my father had just died the year before, so she missed seeing him. But she'd come to Chicago to kind of get reacquainted.
Very Hemingway-esque about that. Hemingway-esque about that. So what did you expect when you enlisted? What did you expect to get out of the Army or to do in the Army?
Well, I thought about, you could go in as a lawyer. I was through law school. Mm-hmm. I'd had a year of practice before I enlisted. But then because there was a war on, that was regarded as a safer slot.
Think.
So,
sure,
you could be a lawyer, but you had to sign up for 4 years.
Right.
If you were drafted, you'd be in for 2 years, but you might go to Vietnam.
You might be in Vietnam.
So that was not on my list of to-dos, but I found kind of an intermediate choice. If I enlisted for 3 years in the intelligence branch, I thought, that is probably going to be more interesting, whatever it turns out to be, than the infantry or an artillery position.
Exactly.
So that's kind of what brought me in there.
Well, it did turn out to be interesting, being a word with a big umbrella under it. I mean, talk about what did you do? What were you charged with doing, Bill?
Well, I went through, after basic training, intelligence school, which at that time was at Fort Halliburton in Baltimore. And I got assigned when that school was over late in 68. To the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, which was part of the Office of the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence of the Army at the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finally figured out where their offices were, because it wasn't...
it took you some time. Yeah, right.
Because they were not... there wasn't a big sign out front.
It's Army Intelligence. Come on in.
They, by happenstance, they needed a counterintelligence analyst to support the newly established, it had just been started, it was a Department of Defense joint service group called the Civil Disturbance Planning and Operations Directorate. And the idea was they'd learned from the race disturbances in Detroit.
In
67, and then...
Then Chicago.
Chicago. But after Detroit, the Secretary of the Army took a look at what happened in Detroit, and the Army was not remotely prepared at that time for a domestic civil disturbance control mission where they're getting involved, because not only the police, local police, state police, but the National Guard can't control a situation.
Exactly.
And after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of 68, all of a sudden, the National Guards in Baltimore, Washington, Chicago were insufficient, and federal troops, which is historically an extremely rare intervention, came into Baltimore, Washington, and Chicago all at the same time.
Yeah.
So, in the after action report, the Army people responsible for the mission thought they'd better reorder their thinking in a big way, because this was a problem that was not going to go away.
No question.
So one of the things they did, and this is why I happened to get there at the time this new organization was set up, was they wanted a flexible organization that would only expand once there was a problem.
Yeah.
So you had a central group of managers at the Pentagon, and that was I was assigned to support DCDPO. The Pentagon has got more acronyms in it than.
Did you enjoy your time?
Well, the work was absolutely fascinating
because
the job was. And this wasn't the only thing I did.
Oh, of course.
But most of the job, most of my time, was reading the internal security production of the time. So the Army had its own problems. There were new Army draftees that were trying to organize unions in the Army, which the Army never thought that was a very good idea.
I'm sure.
So they were trying to keep track of that kind of thing internally in the organization. And then mostly, though, it was external agencies, non-military agencies, so the FBI and other federal agencies.
Were you happy to get out?
After 3 years? Are you kidding?
Yeah. No, I'm not kidding.
No, I was delighted. I was not ever cut out to be a lifer, I'll tell you.
And what were you then? What were your thoughts to say, okay, I'm getting out in like a month or 2 months or something. What did you want to do?
Well, I thought about I didn't have to come back to Chicago where I'd started practicing.
Yeah, sure.
So I thought, well, maybe I'll go out to San Francisco. I'd seen that a little bit. I thought that was a great
place.
And interesting. And Washington, D.C. was also interesting. But at the end of the day, instead of coming back to the larger Chicago firm that I'd started with right after law school, a spinoff had occurred to a small law firm, and they asked me if I'd jump ship and join them, and so I did.
You were, for a while, you met Bill Singer in law school, in your second year of law school?
No, but during law school, I met him because I was a summer clerk at this Ross Hardy's law firm, and he had been newly graduated from Columbia Law School, and so we had to know each other then, and he was also one of the founding partners of the smaller firm that I joined when I got out of the Army.
And then he said to you, and we'll carry on getting the political life of you, he then said, hey, I'm the alderman of the 43rd Ward, and I think I'm going to run for mayor. I remember that vividly. And he, you joined the campaign full time.
Yes, he asked me if I'd take a leave from the law firm and be the general counsel of the campaign, but also he needed somebody to do the research for the campaign, the policy work.
Did you think he had a chance?
I certainly hoped he did.
Yeah,
I don't think I was, had stars in my eyes that this was some easy task.
Because he was running against Richard J. Daley.
That's right. Now, what's interesting is that the way that election turned out was very different. Daley could run up total in the Democratic primary. He could run up totals in the 70%.
Sure.
Low 80s.
Always did, yeah.
But that year Singer and a couple of others ran against him, there was a shocking come down. He only got 55% of the Democratic primary. He didn't even get a majority of the black vote, which was the first time that had happened.
First time ever, yeah.
And I like to think of the fact that as a result of my hard work in that campaign, I was able to hold his vote total under 30%.
And you got to meet the one and only Don Rose. We will continue on after the news with Bill Bowe. Once again, the website is WBOWE.com. And to buy his book titled Riots and Rockets, we've only touched on some of the things that Bill has done in his remarkable life. Go to Amazon.com and you'll find it there. After the news, we'll be back. Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Bilbo, the author of Riots and Rockets. It is a intensely, I know it goes a little far afield, but it's an intensely wonderful recollection of a time in Chicago and some very raucous, life-altering times. When you wrote this book, Bill, because it's so wonderfully detailed. I mean, I see all, and I'm looking at one page, I see Don Rose, Basil Talbot, Mike Royko, and a bunch of, and Ron Dorfman, a bunch of other people. Did you trust your memory when writing this book?
Absolutely not.
Because I'm stunned by the detail. Love the detail.
The detail is a genetic advantage I have. My mother was a pack rat.
Okay.
And she, in her lifetime, kept track of all the papers she ever ran across and was highly organized. And she wrote late in her life as a widow a lengthy genealogy of her husband's family and her own family. Hmm. And I watched her do this, and the paper that she had that she'd been carrying around in files, it was just so I think that's the gene that I caught. So when I retired, I was carting around with me a couple of file cabinets.
Oh, that's fabulous.
And when I retired, I started going through it. And, of course, as usual, you throw out at that point and wonder why you carried around your lifetime. But the nuggets that were left really permitted me to do the research.
Yeah, and you must have well, here's a long section about Rob Warden. You must have, at some point, Bill, did you ever sit back and say to yourself, good Lord, I've had an interesting life?
Well, I think maybe once I retired. Yeah. And also, when the lockdown came and I began thinking at first about writing what I didn't write when I got out of the Army, and I thought I'd write a book at that time, and it wasn't in me at that time.
Sure.
But it was then that I thought, well, I'm going to write up something about the Army because that was just fantastic in a weird way.
Yes, absolutely.
And particularly the whole part of that experience, which had nothing to do with civil disturbances and anti-war demonstrations and riots. Mm-hmm. It had to do with really the dawn of the space age.
Right,
and
sure.
And here, just barely a decade after Sputnik in 1969, the Army sends me out to Kwajalein Atoll in the far western Pacific, south central Pacific, out west of Hawaii, to do a study on the sabotage threats to the anti-ballistic missile system.
Wow.
And so to have that part of the Army experience, yeah, too. So when I sat down to write kind of a short account of my Army experience, and it grew to 12,000 words, and then when that finished, the lockdown was still going on, and I thought, well, now what else did I see in my life that was a little bit interesting to me?
It's just so striking and stunning to me. You do a really wonderful job when you're back in Chicago and working for Bill, mm-hmm, working with Bill, not for him. But you were at one of the most exciting and crazy times in the newspaper business here too.
Absolutely.
What got you? How did the MacArthurs come into your life?
I was practicing law at this law firm most of the 70s that I joined after the Army.
Yeah.
And there was a lawyer there one day who said, you know, I was talking to one of my former law professors at Northwestern, and he said that he knows somebody that's looking for somebody to be a general counsel lawyer, to be a general counsel of their company. And I was doing that kind of work in a private law practice for companies mostly. And so I looked into it, and it turned out to be this company that was had originally been started under the
Bradford?
The Bradford Exchange was the name of the company, but it was owned by the son of John D. MacArthur. And,
right.
And the company had its origins in the enormous Bankers Life and Casualty Company insurance combine that the father had built into this enormous behemoth that ultimately went to it was sold, and the proceeds of billions of dollars went to the MacArthur Foundation.
Yeah. How did you like the MacArthurs? I've heard many, many things about that.
Well, I never knew the father.
That family.
I never knew the father who died, I think, at around 71.
Yeah,
but
right.
By all accounts, he was a cantankerous.
That's what I heard.
Foul-mouthed, yeah. Cantankerous.
Like many Chicago millionaires. Like many Chicago millionaires.
And he had a very, very rotten relationship with his son, who was my client.
Right.
So,
who was that? Was that Rod?
Was Roderick MacArthur, his only son. So Rod had worked for his father for, well, through to middle age.
Yeah.
And it was just abuse by the elder of the young'un in terms of...
You certainly weren't there when they started the so-called genius grants, were you?
Yes. And in fact, this was one of the great contributions that Rod made, although he was spending most of his time when I was working for him fighting with his fellow directors on the MacArthur Foundation, which had just been established. Jumped in a completely positive way was in being the lead director, really, to... root for and figure out the details of what became their Fellows Program, but the media has called it always the genius.
That happened right away, and I remember everybody in the world wanted one of those things, and still do, I suppose. Did you, you seem to have, Bill Bowe, you have a wonderful personality, but you seem to have gotten along with a wide variety of people. Do you give yourself credit for that?
Well, I don't know. I suppose I was just brought up that way get your hand out, and you shake somebody's hand. You get your hand out there first, and
be honest. Yes,
and particularly, of course, in a law practice. You're really trading on your judgment and good sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's really I always looked at law practice as highly refined common sense.
Interesting. Talk to me about United Press International. There's another chapter, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, UPI was founded in 1907 as a competitor to the Associated Press.
Yeah.
And back, so here we are early in the last century, there was a terrible problem for the news business in part because the people that were running newspapers, of course, were hiring reporters locally. So it was a city-by-city basis.
Sure.
And there weren't many newspaper owners at that time that could afford to have reporters in a faraway city like Washington.
Except
or
Colonel Robert R. McCormick. Yeah,
yes.
That's the Tribune.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So their idea was these individual paper owners were let's create a cooperative, and we'll have these reporters all over. They'll work for the Associated Press is what they called it. And they had one basic rule, though, and that was that the feed of the AP wire service, all this news from all over the country and then later the world from the AP, it could only go to the one member of the AP in any given city.
Right, of course. Yeah, sure.
So the UPI got started by E.W. Scripps in Cincinnati because here
the other papers.
Well,
this is the time, ladies and gentlemen. Many cities in this country had more than one paper.
Yes, of the olden days.
Yes,
yeah,
we still
yeah.
have two here, but. Yeah. And what was that like? It seems there were a couple of idiots running the company.
Yes. What happened was that Scripps had owned it throughout most of the 20th century. But by 1970-ish, the wire service was losing money. The heirs to Scripps said, hey, get rid of this thing. You don't need
cash
it.
Cash out.
And there were legal liabilities if they continued to lose money like that. So they tried to sell it. They tried to sell it to NPR Radio and to CBS, and none of the logical media buyers wanted to buy this second banana wire service. And finally, they were so desperate to sell it that two young Nashville entrepreneurs who'd made a little bit of money by getting some FCC television licenses for low-power television stations, so they'd made a little bit of money this way, they popped up and said, we'll buy it. And, of course, they didn't have enough money to actually do anything with it.
Didn't know what they were doing.
But Scripps was so desperate to unload it.
Sure.
They sold it for a dollar. And then they put in about $5 million of operating capital and said, good luck.
Man, that is desperate to sell. That is desperate to sell. Did you, around that time, did you in the sense what has happened to newspapers? It would be impossible to have known that.
Well, yes and no. What I remember vividly, particularly in the late 90s, when the internet was beginning to get started, an early a victim, if you will, that was forced into a transformation was Encyclopedia Britannica, where I had become executive vice president and general counsel. And it was buffeted wildly from a financial standpoint, and indeed changed ownership as a result in the early mid 90s. So the newspaper industry hadn't at all been touched by the internet, that part. Mm-hmm. And the way the reporters in the industry looked at a victim of the new internet, like Encyclopedia Britannica, which is an odd survivor today, and more than a survivor, it's thriving today over the internet.
That's amazing. I want to talk about that.
But in any event, the newspapers didn't know what was coming after them.
We certainly
didn't. I had been going through it, shock to a company when you're being displaced by a major technological change, this secular change in the business environment that's going to just upend everything. Now we think about artificial intelligence perhaps with the same power.
When we come back after a short little break, we will finish off this hour with Bill Bowe. Again, the book is titled Riots and Rockets. You can go to Bill's website, which is fabulous. If you want to see pictures, go to Bill's website, too, WBOWE.com. We'll be back in a couple minutes to talk to Bill about Britannica, which is, you say it's thriving now.
Yes, indeed.
Amazing, amazing, amazing. We'll be back. Bill Bowe, who has been on this since 5 o'clock talking about his life and his book, his life is really captured in vivid, vivid, vivid pages in his book, Riots and Rockets. His website, which is what you can visit, is WBOWE.com, and you can go to Amazon to buy his book. It is a real... It goes far afield from Chicago here and there, but it's basically, I like to think of this as a real Chicago-centric book. You must be pleased with it, Bill. It's an accomplishment to write. It's an accomplishment to write a book, and it's also a different kind of accomplishment to write a book about yourself.
Yes, actually, one of the things that concerned me a little bit was... here were these stories that I had about five stories that were, to me, very interesting.
No question.
Historically important in some respects, or they spoke to some larger historical development. And I had this just in the nature of my job. I had this. I was in the middle of it.
Yep.
And so when I started writing this stuff down and researching it to be able to make the historical context rich and full beyond what was my immediate experience, I didn't want to get boring. To me, a book that's a lawyer's biography.
Yes, would tend to
I mean,
be on the boring
side. I might read a biography or an autobiography of John Marshall, but so that was a little bit of a concern, but that produced, I think, a better, larger picture result.
I do too. Your wife of many years, Kathy, was she your first reader, or did she care about this before you finished it?
I think I was snookered away in my office.
Did you?
Yes. So I was not handing drafts along, and it was just really grinding away with the research and filling in the historical gaps.
The seeing your life and putting your own life between covers can be a very, I think, a very, very empowering thing. Was it for you?
Well, yes, to be able to have the time and the concentration to go back over your life and look at it in detail, and you have to revisit in this kind of a things the things that aren't so happy in your past life as well. And it reminds me a little bit. I got to Britannica a little bit after Charles Van Doren, who had a grand scandal in the late 50s when he—
Quiz show.
On the quiz show scandal, where he was fed answers without the public knowing on television. And he had to admit all of this before Congress in hearings. And he, at the time, if you remember, he was on NBC on the National Today program.
Oh, he was a big deal.
And so here he was, a college professor, an English professor at Columbia.
And the
Son of a distinguished poet. And here it becomes this national pariah.
Oh, no.
And it kills his career in academics, to say nothing, of course, of his new television career. And he goes to work for Encyclopedia Britannica. And what makes me, in answer to your question about taking a look at your life in this way, here he had to live the entire rest of his life, and he was a young man, with this
cloud
that followed him wherever he went. And He got to Britannica, and he was helping to write books that Britannica commissioned. But he had taught English at Columbia early on, and he was asked by a class that he had taught at their 40th reunion if he'd come back and talk to them about whatever he wanted to talk about it. And this is in the book, and it's quite poignant as I remember it, because what he says to them is, you may remember reading with me back 40 years ago about Aristotle's idea of happiness. And in case you've forgotten, I'll tell you, he says that it's really at the end of a life. When you look back, it's not some fleeting momentary moment of pleasure or a feel-good instant. It's at the end of a life being able to look back and be happy. And he concludes this remarks. I was paraphrasing him. And he says, it makes sense, doesn't it? Now, here he is talking to this class of former students. All of them, of course, like everybody else, and they in particular, must know how difficult that is for him to allude to his life. So
it's kind of haunting.
Yeah, kind of haunting. I met him once. He came back for Mortimer Adler's funeral at Quint St. Chrysostom's in the Near North Side, and he really described Adler very well. And I went up and chatted with him afterwards, and I told him what a good job he'd done with Adler. He said Mortimer Adler had, when he'd fallen in the mud, Mortimer Adler picked him up, brushed him off, and gave him a job at Britannica writing books that were just the greatest books.
Wow.
He was quite a figure, and I had been doing work on a project he had started with a Greek translation of the Britannica. Mm. And when when I talked to him, he got a big smile. He was remembering his past. And you could see that couple of decades he spent with Britannica out of the limelight really gave him the chance to say, you know, I've had a happy life.
What do you say?
I say I've made it, and I'm not done with it either.
Exactly. Do you think you might have, because there are parts of this book where you might have, you didn't want an 800-page book like Barbara Streisand's biography, but where you could have expanded. You could write a book, I think, wholly about local Chicago politics.
Yes, and what a fascinating subject.
No question.
But the part of the book that I deal with, in which deals with the 70s and the 80s of Chicago politics, that was such wet my appetite. It was so much fun to be involved in politics in that period. It was a crazy period, particularly, and we had a full range of magnificent personalities. Oh. You had Jane Byrne.
McMullen. You had Mike Rico. You had all these people. Bill, it's a wonderful book, and it's a wonderful read, and you're a good, fine writer. Don Evans is right about everything he said. Again, ladies and gentlemen, the complete title of the book is Riots and Rockets, A Dash of the Army, A Dose of Politics, and A Life in the Law. Very, very focused on Chicago, but travels all over the place. It's dedicated to your wife and kids. And
my genealogy-loving mother.
That's right, and your genealogy-loving mom. Bill, great success with this. You can get it on Amazon easily. And write another one.
All right.
That's what I say.